Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have part two of our interview with Jack Neary, an interview I enjoyed very, very much. Jack was a former writer for Muscle Builder and Power magazine back in the late 70s. I think Jack started working for them in 76, and I think he only did it for about 4 years. He was done by 1980. So today we're going to pick up where we left off last week, and we're going to continue our interview with Jack. He's going to talk a little bit about Gold's Gym, and he's also going to talk about his relationship with Robbie Robinson. He's going to talk about what he knows about Cal Scalak when he met Cal. And then finally, we're going to talk about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which Jack was in attendance at, and he wrote one of the pivotal articles about that event for Muscle Builder magazine. So it's going to be another really great interview with Jack Neary. I enjoyed that one last week very much. Next week, we're going to have John DeCola. So I finally got John on the show. He will be joining us next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. John was the 1969 IFBB Mr. America, and he will be 82 years old this year, and he looks fantastic. He sounds fantastic. The epitome of health. So we got the chance to talk to John out at his home in Massachusetts. So he will be joining us next week. So that's something to look forward to. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. After our episode with Jack, I'm going to read a couple more articles. One was from, I'm not sure when it's from, I think it was the summer of 1978. And this is about Robbie Robinson. It's kind of a long article, but Jack Neary wrote it, so it's very, really well done. And I'm also going to read a flash report that Jack did about the 1979 Night of the Champions, where Danny Padilla scored its perfect 300 score, and Robbie beat him for the overall. So we're going to talk about that as well. So Robbie won the first two Night of the Champions in 78 and 79. So Jack Neary has a flash report on that. So we'll read that as well. All right. What else is going on? Hope you guys are training and doing well. My training is going up, getting stronger. I'm on my MP6 workout, a workout routine I developed. And basically it's cycles of power training and then mass training. So I'm doing the power training now, which is great because I need to build up my strength because I was off for 6 weeks. And it seems like more than muscle mass, I lost more strength than anything. So I'm getting stronger gradually each week, and workouts are really going good. I just finished up week 4, my power cycle. So I've got 2 more weeks to go with that, and then I will start my mass cycle. So I'm going to try and get leaner later this year, maybe around the spring, and maybe do some more photos or maybe a photo shoot. Try to do that at once every couple of years, and been kind of delayed with these hernia surgeries I've had the last 2 years. So I'll see if I can put it together this year. I want to mention a few birthdays last week. My good friend Mel Chansey, who I used to train with back in the 90s in Chicago. Mel was the leader of the Hell's Angels in Chicago at the time when we were training together. He was a really big guy. He was like about 260. And since then, Mel's really changed his life around. he went to prison and he got out and he found the Lord and he got married. And now he's a contest promoter out here in Florida. He lives out in Florida like I do. He lives in Port Charlotte, I think. And Mel's really, really changed his life around. He's a great, great guy. And the last time I talked to him, we had him on our show with Ed Connors. Mel was saying that The Rock was going to do a story about his life. And it was going to be like a docudrama, I think. So hopefully that's going well. I haven't talked to Mel in a while. But happy birthday to him. And on that same day was Dr. Robert Goldman, Dr. Bob. His birthday was also on that same day, which was February 23rd. And the other guy whose birthday was that day was my friend Merle Hall, who is my idol. Merle is 80 years old now. He got his 80th birthday this year. Probably heard some of my talk about Merle. He was a natural bodybuilder. He competed in Chicago. And he started competing in his 20s. And about 10 years ago, when he was 70, he got his pro card at the MPC Masters Nationals in the over 70 division. And we call him Mr. Abs because he's got great abs. And so now Merle is 80 years old, still living in Decatur, Illinois. He just posted a video on his Facebook page where he was doing a two-finger pull-up. So both hands using two fingers, he was able to do about three or four pull-ups at 80 years old. So like I said, he's my idol because he's the epitome of health. He's been natural his whole life, and he's in fantastic condition. So happy birthday to Merle. Let's see, what else? Oh, my mom and dad are coming out to visit me in Florida. They're coming out tomorrow, so they're going to be out here for 2 weeks, so that'll be great to see them. I haven't seen them since last year when they came out to Florida before the COVID thing hit. So, yeah, I think it was about a year, exactly a year ago. It was last February. And my brother's coming out, too, with his wife, so it'll be great to see everybody again. I haven't seen anybody in about a year because of the coronavirus, so it'll be great to see my family again. All right. We did get a few emails from last week. I got a few emails on Apple iTunes. So if you listen to the podcast on Apple iTunes, you could go there and leave a review for us. I would really appreciate it because I think it helps our ratings if you do that. I got an email here from Sweden and he says, great show with a great insight into the golden age of bodybuilding. And this one says, I have listened to all your shows. Everyone is better than the last one. When you were reading the article about Ron Thompson, that was great. I competed against him at the Mr. Midwest in Cincinnati. It brought back many memories. Thanks again, Tim Christ. And this one is from the Asian Rock in Great Britain. He says, work at a local hospital in the evening. This podcast always gets me through my shift. Keep up the great work. If you want to email me, by the way, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. Any comments on the show, any suggestions for guests or anything you want to say, just send it to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com and I'll read it on the air. This one's from William Chill from Sweden. So we got a lot of international emails this week. That's great. He says, hello, John. Thank you for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Your effort to bring alive the colorful stories of a bygone era are greatly appreciated and mean a lot to me. I particularly enjoyed your interview with Jack Neary, as me and my friends used to devour all the magazines that came out back in the day. The various publications were largely responsible for fostering a love for the sport and building a sense of community. Many people talk about how there is a certain kind of poetry associated with boxing, a sport described by the writer Norman Mailer as the sweet science. I believe the same can be said for bodybuilding, and the likes of Jack Neary, Rick Wayne, and other writers have done their share to lift our sport to a similar level. I'm convinced that one day it will be recognized as such. I do a little bit of writing myself, and I enjoy writing about the old days. I've attached a short piece here that I think your listeners would enjoy. If you see the occasion to read it aloud on your show, it would mean a lot to me. So I'm going to read that article that William wrote at the end of our interview with Jack Neary, along with those other two articles I'm going to read from Jack himself. All right. Let's see. I got a couple comments on my Facebook page. Raymond Cesar said, amazing interview, John Hansen. I loved it. And Mark Martinez said, Jack's focus on what made the guys tick versus just writing another article about sets and reps is an insight into not only who Jack Neary is and what made him a great writer, but it set Weider's Muscle Builder apart during that era as well. No small wonder that Jack became very successful and celebrated creative director in the advertising world after his Muscle Builder days at BBDO. And we got a couple comments on my YouTube page. I put these interviews on YouTube as well. So if you guys subscribe to YouTube, please subscribe to my channel, which is under my name, John Hansen. And each week you can see the interviews that we do on the podcast, they will also be exactly on YouTube. But I add pictures and I add sometimes videos, so it's a little bit more enjoyable to watch. This one was from William Flynn. He says, "This guy is a great interview. I can't wait for part two." Austin Clark said, "I enjoyed the interview. I still got all the magazines from back then." Stefano said, "This is a great interview." Ivan Gardino said, "Excellent interview, John." The GIF said, "John, you have some of the best interviews covering past and present. Lots of value and lessons here with Jack. Thanks for posting." The Spritz said, "Amazing interview. More." Howard said, "Great interview, John. I'm looking forward to part two." Stephen Roberts said, "I can't wait for part two. I love the Arnold stories." Gentero said, "I love the old stories." Leno said, "So good, John. Awesome stories." Dark Solera said, "Great as always. Thank you." Robert DeMero said, "Great video. Some of your best videos are with the writers of the magazines. Thanks, John." Good Always Wins Over Evil said, "Brilliant video, John." G said, "Hey, John, I just found your channel and I watched several of your videos. Absolutely brilliant content. I'm 52 and I have met and spoken to several of the golden era bodybuilders. I love the old stories. Keep them coming. All the best from the UK." Dan Smith said, "Great listen." And Hitching to Health said, "Great video." All right. So thank you for those comments, guys. And like I said, if you guys want to email me about anything, just go to naturalolympia@gmail.com. And be sure to check out our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And also, as I said, checking out on YouTube as well. All right. So that's all I got. Kind of a short intro this week. Here is part two of our interview with Jack Neary, one of the great writers from Muscle Builder magazine. Here we go. So what did you think of Cal when you met him? Because I was always a big fan of Cal. I got into bodybuilding, like I said, in 77, and that was the year he won the Universe. And I remember reading Muscle Builder every month up until that Universe. And like you said, everybody was kind of predicting Mike was going to win easy. And then I remember it said, it had that on the cover, Cal defeats the critics or something. And they had a double bicep shot of him and he won the Universe. So I was like, wow, this guy's like the underdog. And I remember at that point, he had never lost a contest, right? He won every show he went into. I think Delaware, Mr. USA, Mr. America, Mr. California, and then he won the Universe.
Yeah, he really just came out of nowhere, at least to my eyes. And he was impressive, and he was a really nice guy. As I said, just a very honest, straight shooter of a guy. You know, I just remember little things, like I went over to his house, and he was in his contest diet, and he said he never drank juice, like apple juice or orange juice. He would rather eat the fruit, the whole fruit instead. He said, "I get so little food that I'd rather eat something I can get my teeth into than drink it, you know, the calories that form." But Cal was one of those guys who kind of stayed to himself a little bit. He was never quite caught up in the scene, the Gold's Gym scene, the way a lot of the other guys were. Not that he was unfriendly. He was a really lovely guy, but he really did shut up the critics with that performance. And of course, then the big fallout with Weider happened, and he did the crucifixion reenactment. I wasn't at that Olympia, but I remember Mike Mensur telling me about it. And it was a pretty dramatic moment, you know? And then he kind of ended up kind of falling out of the game. And I think he went into cycling or something like that.
Yeah. He's a competitive cyclist now.
I mean, he's a very driven guy, very athletic. And so, I mean, I'm not surprised he would do well in another field. But
he was real strong too, right, Jack, in the gym?
Pardon me?
He was strong too, right?
Yeah, oh, very strong. Yeah, he could really bench a lot and behind the neck press. And, you know, that was another myth, you know, the time that only the weightlifters were strong. But there were some really strong bodybuilders, I have to say.
Yeah. What did Arnold think of Cal? Because I think they were touting Cal as like the new Arnold when he came out.
Yeah, well, he certainly had the chest and biceps peaks of Arnold, you know, had that same kind of look. And although Arnold had more than Cal did, I think. But I don't know. I mean, I don't really remember what Arnold said about Cal. I mean, he must have been impressed by him, but I don't recall ever him voicing a specific opinion. You know, by then Arnold was so caught up. I mean, he was still very much interested in bodybuilding, but he was really developing his business and his acting career that I don't think he spent as much time in the scene in those later years.
Yeah. What was Gold's Gym like, the first one, the one in Venice, on Pacific Avenue, the one in Venice?
Well, that's where, of course, it all started. It was a really impressive facility. It was a kind of a nondescript cinder block, little block of a building, a couple stories high. It had high ceilings, lots of air, not a lot of windows, a few windows in the front, but a lot of mirrors, of course, which accentuated the space. And there was the time when they had these really cool schematic mechanical drawings emblazoned on the walls of like train cars, like really heavy metal kind of stuff. But those were gone by the time I came in there, and there was more just big posters of some of the big names of the day. But it wasn't the biggest gym in the world, but it was a good size. But as I said, it was a smaller scene back then. But there was a handful of regulars: Eddie Giuliani, Ken Waller, Robbie. You know, you'd always bump into those guys pretty much every day, depending on the time of the day. I would always go in the evenings after working at Woodland Hills at Weeder, and then come in on the Saturday morning. Saturdays were always fun. You know, there was a lot of the guys would come in, Jerry Branham, all kinds of really great guys from those days. It was a great spirit. That's one of the things I noticed covering other sports versus bodybuilding. There's a kind of a camaraderie, a fraternity among bodybuilders that you don't see maybe as strongly in some other sports. And even though they were competitors, there was a really good spirit of kindred souls together and friendliness that, I was really impressed by.
Okay.
But the gym, it had a great vibe, a great energy. It was a really wonderful place. I stayed. It's funny. I ended up staying for a long weekend in that building after Ken Sprague turned it into his private residence. Because by then he had moved the gym up into Santa Monica on, I think, 2nd Avenue.
Yeah.
The second iteration of Gold's Gym. This is before they were franchising all over the world and before Tim Kimber and Pete Grimkowski bought it. And then moved it back to Venice and then had franchises all over the world. So this was the second gym, but then Ken Sprague and his wife, Mary, and turned that place into their home. And they used to keep these giant parrots, these macaws. And they had 5 or 6 of these big birds, nasty beasts. I'll tell you, they take your finger off. He said, we're going away for the weekend. Would you mind house sitting for us and feeding the birds? And so I had quite an education on how to care for a giant parrot.
Right.
But, it was pretty fun. I was so worried about them escaping from the cage. But so I got to see the place as a home, which it was really a nice job that they'd done in turning it into a living quarters. Yeah. But the second Gold's Gym was also a great place. I mean, that's where Mensur used to hang out, Ray and Mike, and the Barbarian brothers were there then. And Robbie was there.
Danny Padilla.
Yeah, Danny used to come out from Rochester quite a bit. And and then there was sort of was a faction, like Arnold kind of ended up training with his friend Joe Gold at World Gym. I used to go there occasionally. And that was the whole scene there, Franco and Arnold. And then there was kind of the rest of the Gold's Gym scene up and back in Santa Monica. And of course, then you get visiting bodybuilders of note that would come through for a few weeks, guys from Europe, guys from Australia, wherever, would kind of get a little apartment, a hotel room on the beach and stay for a couple of months, getting themselves ready for whatever contest.
Yeah. When did you meet Lou Ferrigno?
I guess I would have met Lou. It might have been at the 76 America. Not that he was in it, but he might have been there. I think I met him. Maybe he was a judge or was hanging around the scene.
He was in New York. Yeah, I remember seeing pictures of him and his father with Arnold there.
Yeah, and it was right after Pumping Iron had come out. And I'd only known Lou through the film and the book. I was always impressed by Lou. And he was a lovely guy. Lou was a really nice guy. I became very friendly with him when he came out west. And I remember him when he first got the role in The Hulk. He invited me onto the set of the filming of the show. I met Bill Bixby and, did a little story about the making of The Hulk at the time. Lou was very, very gracious and very, very nice guy. He stole one of my girlfriends. I was dating this girl who was a pre-med student and he liked her too. I don't know. I mean, I guess she was a little more impressive than I was and she ended up going with him, but I've never discussed that with him, but just a little aside.
That bastard.
Yeah.
I remember that picture you took with him where he's doing the side chest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was at the second Gold's Gym on Second Street or Avenue, whatever it was. I mean, quite a difference there. But he was a massive guy. And of course, he got in tremendous shape later in life, you know, I mean, his 40s.
Yeah.
It was just monstrous, you know.
I always wonder how he would have did in that 77 Olympia, because I remember he was training all year for that. He moved out to California that year and he was getting, I remember in the magazines, he was getting better shape every month.
So yeah.
I would have did.
Well, I'm sure he would have done well. He had really very few flaws. I mean, he was really well balanced and he had such size and mass and, you know, and he was a good poser too. I mean, he had a huge presence, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And of course, Frank Zane, he was a wonderful figure. You know, Frank also was a guy that kind of kept himself a little bit removed from the day-to-day scene, but he spent a lot of time out in Palm Springs. But I went to his home one day and met his lovely wife, Christine, did an interview there, and very bright guy. He was a school teacher, very intelligent, very analytical mind. And he, you know, he did so much with, you know, he didn't have the sheer size of a lot of the guys, but he was just the epitome of symmetry and balance and just a world-class poser. I mean, right up there with Ed Corney.
Yeah.
And had a huge following, Frank Zane. Oh, yeah. was a great figure.
Now, Frank wrote his own articles, right?
Well, I don't remember. I remember interviewing him a couple of times and then writing them as under my own byline, but about Frank. Right. He may, Arm and Tanny may have done a couple of Franks, but Frank may have written a few of his own. He certainly was a bright guy and could have done it.
It seemed like when I read his articles, it seemed like it was coming from him. You know, he would get really into the specifics of how he trained and, you know, his whole philosophy, his whole strategy for that year, how he's going to get ready for the contest, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if he penned a lot of them. Definitely.
What did you think of Frank when he was winning that Mr. Olympia? Because I just heard a podcast recently, and they said that Frank Zane was the most overrated bodybuilder ever, and the guy looks like a swimmer and all this stuff. You know, we see that from some of these newer guys who weren't around during that time, and they didn't get to see Frank on stage.
You know, I used to know guys that would knock Frank too because he just wasn't that big. But I'll tell you, I stood beside Frank Zane many times, and I was impressed. He wasn't didn't have the mass of Arnold or Sergio or guys like that. Yeah. But I'll tell you, he carried a lot of muscle.
Yeah,
he wasn't the skinny guy. You know, he was a very impressive physique, and well honed and very refined. I mean, he had intercostals like nobody. You know, and he could do the vacuum pose like so much better than so many others. And you know, he was an impressive. He had a great presence. You know, even beside a guy with the mass of Franco. So I give him his due. I always had great respect for Frank. And he was a classy guy too. Very classy guy.
Yeah, I saw him win all three of his Olympias, and I thought he deserved every one of them, you know. I think people today, you know, the guys today are so big that they can't relate to a bodybuilder under 200 pounds. Like, he was only 185 pounds or whatever, but they can't understand how a guy, but if you look at the shows back then, they had the under 200 and over 200 pound class at the Olympia, and there was always more guys in the under 200. You know, there was always like only four or five guys in the over 200. And Frank was always one of the biggest guys in that class. And I always thought, you know, with his conditioning and the definition he had and the way he presented his physique, I always thought he was a worthy winner.
Yeah, definitely. He was. And Joe knew that. I mean, Joe never shied away from featuring him, giving him lots of space in the magazine on the cover.
Right.
Because Joe knew that Frank had a very strong following. And, you know, it was a certain school, you know, a little different aesthetic than some of the mass monsters. But, and of course, you know, as you say, what they become these days is even, it's a whole other planet now.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, the first guy I met who, of that next generation of really big guys was Lee Haney.
Okay.
And he had a hell of a physique. I mean, he was really a great physique, but he'd come to the offices. It was during the last stages of my time there in 1980 or so. And he'd come from Atlanta. I think that's his home. I remember Joe had him. If a new guy came in the office, Joe would immediately have him disrobe and pose for him in his office, you know. And so Lee was standing there in his underwear. And I mean, wow, this guy was impressive. And of course, we all know what he went on to do. But it became a whole different era after that, and my time kind of ended. But a lot, you know, it's what a wonderful world it really is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about Robbie, because I know you wrote a few articles about Robbie, and I remember the one you wrote about where he talked about his Vietnam experience.
Yeah.
So you know him pretty well, right?
Yeah. Robbie was just a lovely, kind, you know, really good guy. I really liked Robbie, you know, and we spent a lot of time. I used to go over his apartment and he'd tell me these stories of serving in the Vietnam. He got a Purple Heart for being wounded and, you know, not all that, not stories that he would normally open up about that much, because I think he saw stuff that, you know, can really give a guy a post-traumatic stress disorder. But he was really determined, you know, came from nothing in Florida, was a great athlete, was a really good track star and football player in his own right. Mm-hmm. And I wrote his courses for him, and he introduced me to a whole world of music I never knew about, like Lonnie Liston Smith, this great jazz pianist. And we mm-hmm. went to a concert of his at the Inglewood Forum, where the Lakers play today. It's called the Staples Centers. Now, we went one night to see Lonnie Liston Smith, and yeah, he was a lovely guy. I got to know his wife, Elaine. I don't know if they're still together, but I've lost touch with a lot of these guys, sadly. But Robbie was a really real gem of a guy. Was making a name for himself in his own right. He had a great physique, incredible V in his back. And, I don't know if he ever went as far as he'd hoped to and, you know, winning the Olympia and that sort of thing. But I tell you, you still see him on Facebook now and again. He's incredible shape. I mean, he's incredible ripped shape. All the
yeah.
time.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just did an interview with Tony Pearson last week, and Tony was training with him. And Tony was telling how he was just an incredible, you know, in the gym, he was so serious and he was so into the workouts and he wouldn't talk to anybody. And everything was so precise and perfect in the way he trained, you know?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Tony Pearson. I gave him his first article.
Oh, really?
Wow. He was a young 19-year-old guy, just a kid from St. Louis, and he was very shy, didn't say too many words. And I introduced myself in the gym one day. This was the second Golds. Yeah. And he was very shy and just kind of withdrawn. But, you know, he and I kind of hit it off, and I did a little story for him. Joe ran it. And, you know, he stayed in great shape as well. I mean, oh, he's very impressive. Yeah.
Glory. He looks amazing. Yeah, he's still so young too, Jack, you know.
Yeah, I know. It looks like he dips his head in formaldehyde every night.
Exactly. So tell me about some of the big shows you went to, Jack, in the late 70s. Did any of them stand out? The Olympias, the Mr. Universe contest, the Americas?
Well, there was the America. It was in Santa Monica, California. I don't know if it was 77 or 78.
The one Danny won?
Danny won it, and there was Pete Grimkowski was in it. Roger Callard was in it.
Yeah, that looked like a fun contest.
Yeah, it was a good show. I mean, Danny was a great. There's a bodybuilder who deserves more praise. I mean, he has such balance and symmetry mass, and you know, not the tallest guy in the world, but really a good guy and a really likable guy too. Quite funny. He deserved everything he ever won. I think he went to, he was in the 77 trip as well to France. And
he won, we
were both lamenting we couldn't find a decent ice cream cone anywhere. And, you know, he liked to eat, I'll tell you, as all bodybuilders do once the contest is behind them. But
he told me a story. Him and Cal were stuck in an airport on the way to France. I don't know where they were. And they were there for like a day or something. They were like using the sink to wash their hair. And, you know, they were stuck out there. And then finally somebody pulled some strings and got them the rest of the way over there, you know?
Yeah, I don't recall that, but I'm not surprised, you know. There's a kind of bond that forms when you travel with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
Armin Tanney and I shared a room over there in this, the most grand hotel you've ever seen in your life, the Negresco Hotel in Nice, France.
Yeah.
And it was just a palace, but we were on these little pull-out cots, you know, because Joe was paying the freight. And, you know, these little with hardly any hot water. And, you know,
yeah.
I remember we saw a guy die of a heart attack on the street in front of the hotel one day. It was bit of a shocker, I'll tell you. But just the stuff you see as you travel. I look back on those Weider years, and it opened so many doors and gave me a chance to see the world in ways it would. You know, so I'm really great. Other contests. I mean, of course, I was there for the famous and controversial 80 Olympia.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because I remember reading your article. Because, you know, back then, of course, we didn't have the internet. We didn't know anything. So I remember I was in the gym in 1980 and some guy comes in and he goes, "Hey, did you guys hear Arnold won the Olympia?" And we're like, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, he blew them all away."
Yeah.
And they had a flash report in Joe's magazine. And it was just like they hinted that there was some controversy. And then your article, I think, came out a month later and you really spelled it out, like what really happened. So that was a great article.
Yeah, it was probably, I think, the best contest report I'd done.
Wow.
And it's funny because I wasn't living down in California at the time. I'd moved back to Canada for a time. And Joe called me out of the blue and he said, "Would you like to go to Australia and cover the 80 Olympia?"
Wow. Okay.
And I said, "Yeah, okay, sure. Why not?" You know, and I remember Joe saying, "You can fly first class up in first class with me and Betty if you want." And I said, no, Joe, I'd rather fly in the back with the bodybuilders because I wanted to sit amongst the guys and hear what they were saying and pick their brains. And because it was all good fodder for the contest report later.
Yeah.
And so Joe couldn't believe I was turning down a first class seat to sit back with the goats and the chickens, you know. But and I tell you, it's the longest flight in the world, you know, flying from Los Angeles to Sydney, just forever, never ending, you know. But you know, we survived it. But there had been rumors, there were just tiny little inklings of rumors that Arnold was maybe, you know, entertaining making a return. He'd been training for Conan. He was in pretty good shape and he was thinking about maybe coming back and maybe shutting up guys like Mike Mentzer and people like that. Mm-hmm. So these were just rumors. And of course, comes the day of the contest and it turns out Arnold was indeed entered.
Yeah.
And there was a great deal of grumbling about this. And the big beef that all the bodybuilders had, other competitors had, was the judging panel. Most of the judges were really close friends of Arnold.
Right.
All good guys, some really big names and guys I was friendly with and respected, but they were really close to Arnold. But there was Reg Park, who was Arnold's idol, of course, as a kid and a dear friend. Mitz Kawashima, who was a gym owner from Honolulu, very close to Arnold. Albert Busek, a lifelong friend of Arnold, a really lovely guy who I really like. There was an Australian guy who no one knew named Brendan Ryan, who was a good friend of Paul Graham, who was a good friend of Arnold. Paul Graham was the promoter of the contest, and he got his friend Brendan on. And he wasn't really qualified to IFBB international standards.
Right.
But, you know, and there might be a couple other guys I'm missing, but there was a bunch of guys that were really close to Arnold. So there was a lot of feeling, hey, is this like kind of a stacked deck?
Yeah.
And then there was this big controversy on the morning of the just before the pre-judging, where there were these two weight classes, was the under 200 and the over 200. And I think there was the feeling amongst the bulk of the bodybuilders, you know, Mike Mentzer, Boyer Coe, Dickerson, Roger Walker, Frank Zane, et cetera, all the guys. Why do we even need the weight classes? Why can't we just have one class?
Right.
Because there really were very few in the over 200 anyway, a few guys, but not as many as you pointed out earlier. And Arnold was adamant that there were two classes. He was just being really stubborn about it and was refusing to bend. And there was this big meeting called in the dressing room area in the Sydney Opera House, this amazing facility. And there are all these guys sitting around their track suits, you know, and before the prejudging, and Arnold's making this impassioned speech for why it should be two classes. And Mike Mentzer was sort of the vocal advocate for the other side and was advocating one class. And there was, you know, Ben Weider was there and Oscar State and all the different officials and judges and all the judges were witnessing this.
Right.
And then Arnold just took the most unbelievable shot at Mike. He said, "Oh, Mike, we all know you lost last year's Olympia because you're a big gut hanging out." And I thought Mike was going to walk over and pound him. Like, really, I said, I've never, it became so close to physical violence.
Yeah.
And it's a real ripple of concern swept through the room. And you know, other guys stepped in, like Boyer stepped up and said, "Okay, let's calm down. Let's calm down." And, yeah, you know, finally cooler heads prevailed and order was kind of restored, and Arnold could sense he was on the losing end of this, and so he kind of acquiesced and said, "Okay, I withdraw my challenge, and you know, we can go with one class, and that's fine."
Yeah.
So peace was restored, and then the prejudging began, and this is the first time I'd ever seen Arnold, right, you know, compete. Yeah, I'd seen him guest pose a couple of times, and he, you know, wasn't in great shape in those middle years, but and I have to say, I was pretty impressed. I mean, Arnold, even though Arnold was nowhere near his best condition, based on stories, eyewitness reports of people who knew him back in the day,
right,
he was still pretty impressive, you know, but he didn't have the size and he looked kind of drawn out. And you had a lot of other guys who came in unbelievable shape. Like Mike Mentzer was in rock hard. He really timed it well that year. Mm-hmm. Chris Dickerson was phenomenal. I actually thought Chris was the best guy on stage.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Zane was in pretty good shape, but he had had a setback, a freak accident,
right,
suntanning in Palm Springs that set him back for a time. So he wasn't quite in his best form. But Boyer Coe was in incredible shape, and he really looked good. And I'm going to miss a bunch of guys. Roger Walker from Australia was in great shape, or England.
He was really
strong. And there was guys like Samir Banu who mistimed things, and they weren't quite the names that they became. Ken Waller wasn't his best, you know, but there was a bunch of guys that were really great.
Yeah.
And Arnold, you know, so Arnold really clearly from the prejudging had his work cut out for him.
What were your feelings, Jack, when you saw, after you watched the prejudging, did you think Arnold was going to win, or did you think someone else was going to win?
No, you know, if I were picking it, and I know it's very subjective,
sure,
but I would have picked Chris Dickerson as the best guy.
Okay.
Even though I was a big Mike Mentzer fan, and Mike was great. I mean, you could argue he was the next best guy, or some would have him number one, but he was certainly top three. And the judges voted, and of course, he was the nemesis of Arnold. And, you know, it's no question in my mind that the Arnold's friends who were on the judging panel marked Mike down to fifth. I think the whole crowd felt that. But, you know, it's not, of course, nothing you can prove. It's just an allegation, but and that's all it is. But
where would you have had Arnold, Jack?
I could have had him second, maybe third.
Okay.
You know, he was still pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And I write some of that off as it was the first time I'd ever seen him, and the legend, you know,
which I'm sure affected a lot of people, some of the judges maybe too. Yeah.
Yeah, but there were a lot of guys who knew him from the day, you know, the 74 era.
Yeah.
And they said, "Oh, he's nothing like that." And
right.
And kind of dismissed him. But, you know, I was pretty impressed by Arnold on the day, but I didn't think he was the best guy.
Did you think his legs were really weak?
Yeah, his legs weren't that great. His back wasn't that good. He was kind of drawn out. He would actually refuse to do certain mandatory poses. Mm-hmm. You know, the judges would call for a certain, like a side back triceps or whatever, and he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. Right. He just wouldn't do it. And you know, normally you'd be penalized for that.
Yeah.
But not this time. And, you know, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. Just had a little bit of an air of things weren't quite on the level was my feeling, you know. But again, it couldn't be certain and you couldn't prove it. But I'll tell you, do you know John Little?
Yes, I interviewed him. Yeah.
John Little, who lives here in Toronto, knew Mike Mentzer really well. He's actually putting together an amazing documentary film about that contest with all kinds of good stuff. I hope he gets it out in the next year or so.
Yeah.
It's a real eye-opener. There was a lot of stuff in there. He sent me a rough cut of it. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I won't say was thunder, but like I never even knew about, you know.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny. So I remember the night of the contest, and Arnold was declared the winner. And I'd never heard anything like this, but the crowd booed Arnold. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a good half of the crowd was jeering him and booing him. And it was he came tumbling down from the upper parts of the balconies, and you know, and this was Arnold, the greatest bodybuilder ever, the legend. And I mean, he just sort of grinned through it all on stage, but it was quite of a shock. And I think we all kind of realized, man, something's not right here. You know, I think a lot of people were cheering for Mike, a lot of people for Chris Dickerson, a lot of guys for Boyer Co. I mean, there were some good guys up there that day. So I remember that, you know, I interviewed Arnold the next day at his hotel and asked him why he came back. And it's all in the report, of course, what he said. And he felt it was a good time to come back and give it a shot. And but he, you know, he wanted Arnold, it was clear to me, wanted to downplay the controversy. Because I went back to Calgary to write the report, and I got a message from Arnold that he was going to be in a little city north of Calgary called Red Deer. He was actually going to do a seminar the following weekend on this Saturday. And he said, I'm going to be in your neck of the woods. Well, why don't we get together and have lunch and talk? And I said, okay. So I drove up, you know, it's an hour's drive or so. And I went north to Red Deer, and I sat in an Arnold seminar, and it wound down, and he saw me and he took me out for lunch. And it was, he says, so, you know, what do you think of the contest, you know, kind of thing. And I told him, you know, I don't think he deserved to win. And that's my intention. And I intend to report that. And he says, and he kind of, in a backhanded sort of way, he says, well, you know, this is not the time to be airing dirty laundry. And he was really trying to keep soft soap the whole thing. And, you know, he made me an offer that I could refuse. He actually offered for me to write his Encyclopedia Bodybuilding along with Bill Dobbins, who he had contracted to work on the book. He said, would you like to write that with Bill on the Encyclopedia Bodybuilding? And I said, well, thank you for the offer. I appreciate it. Let me think about it. So we parted, and he went back to California. I went back to Calgary, and I thought, you know what? I'm not going to accept his offer. I don't want to be in any way tied or beholden to him.
Yeah.
So I wrote Arnold a letter saying thanks for the offer, but I did turn it down. And then I went on to write the story that you read. You know, I think Arnold called me a whore afterward, after the report came out. Yeah, not to my face, but I read about it in a book that came out about him or something. And he, you know, then we sort of had a bit of a falling out because of that. But I bumped into him years later. I was in Venice, and he had a restaurant there called Schatzi's. Which means deer in German. Like his mother used to be called Schatzi. And I heard this booming voice from across the restaurant, and it was Arnold. And I said, oh, so I went up and introduced myself again, and he remembered me, of course. And we had a nice chat. It was very gracious, a really nice chat. And, you know, this is after Mike had died, and, you know, Arnold was in a different phase of his life, and, you know, it's more the older statesman of the game. And, you know, there was no hard feelings about the report I wrote.
Well, I remember. I'll never forget that report, because that kind of opened up the whole controversial part of it. You know, I don't think anybody ever knew that before. You know, before we saw the pictures and stuff, we didn't know how controversial it was. You probably never went to a contest that controversial before, right, Jack? All the other ones you went
to? No, I mean, you know, there was always one or two guys that were mad that they didn't win, and they would break their trophy backstage or whatever. But you know, generally most of the decisions the crowd would agree with. But I'd never seen anything so resoundingly booed as that one. I got to give Joe Weider credit. He didn't change any of the words in the report. He put it all in, you know, warts and all. And Joe was, of course, very close to Arnold and helped create the Arnold mythology, helped him his great break. Joe used to drive me nuts. He would rewrite some of my articles and inject himself into the article. he would always rechange a couple sentences and have him in there. And I that used to drive me nuts, he was the boss, so you kind of went along with it. But one funny story I think your listeners might like to hear, it was the day I discovered there was no Weider Research Clinic. I've been reading about this this fabled place, this facility, the Weider Research Clinic, where all of the great research went on. And I remember one day asking Joe to take me to the clinic so I could see it. And he kind of went red in the face and kind of hemmed and hawed and said, well, there actually isn't one. It's just a fictional thing that we've created, that it's kind of an idea, you know, as opposed to an actual place. And I thought, okay, you know, Joe was a great self-promoter.
Yeah.
You know, I don't blame him. You know, he knew how to turn out a good product.
He did. Yeah. That was a great magazine. That 80 Olympia, though, it's funny now. It's almost over 40 years, and it's still like the most talked about Mr. Olympia ever. You know, every time if I'll post some pictures on Facebook, it's like 40 responses. You know, some people thought Arnold should have won. Some people thought he shouldn't have won. But he does look I guess Arnold did look impressive from the magazine or from the pictures, where he looked impressive enough where people thought he still could have won, you know.
Yeah, he was, I mean, he was no pushover. He was impressive.
Yeah.
He just wasn't to the level that everyone knew him at.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there were guys up there. I'm sure you, John, with your insightful eye, would have said, wow, I would have placed so-and-so or so-and-so ahead of Arnold on that mm-hmm. day. You know, it's very subjective, but that's the name of the game.
Yeah,
and, you know, the fact that there were a number of really close friends of Arnold's on the panel kind of gave guys pause. But it is what it is. It was a historical event. I'm really delighted to have been there to witness it. And it was the last great contest I ever saw. You know, I never really followed it too closely after that. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, I went to the Columbus the next year and saw Franco win.
Yes.
The most controversial one I ever saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Franco, of course, made a great comeback. I was there when he was at that event, the Strongest Man competition for TV, when he tore his knee out carrying a fridge.
Were there? Okay.
Yeah, I was there. I was there going to do a little article about it. And I think Lou Ferrigno was also in it.
Yeah, he was in it.
And Franco, really strong. Like, he was really impressive, of course. But he made the mistake of trying to run with the fridge as opposed to walk really fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you run, of course, sometimes your both feet aren't on the ground. And he came down with so much weight on the one knee, and it just blew it out.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad. I mean, he was really badly hobbled, and it was quite something for him to come back the way he did. I don't know if he ever quite regained the condition that he was in 76, but, you know, he was an impressive guy. It's sad that he died recently.
That was very sad. Yeah.
Very sad.
Yeah. I was there too. I saw one of those shows. My family was on vacation that year in California, and I was only 14 years old, and we didn't even know they were filming that. We went to Universal Studios, and I got a chance to see not only Franco and Lou, but Arnold was also there watching. So I got a chance to see Arnold too at 14. So that was really a great day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why did you get out of writing for Weider, Jack? What did you do?
Well, you know, it's funny. As I said earlier, Joe used to drive me nuts at times. It was a love-hate relationship that we had. Yeah. I revered Joe. He was like a father figure to me. And in fact, I just lost my parents a couple of years before I started working with Joe. Mm. And he kind of became a father figure to me. And I adored him in many ways. But I didn't like it when he rewrote my stuff. And he would do that occasionally. He did for reasons of self-promotion.
Yeah.
And I was young and I was impetuous. And, you know, I had a short fuse in those days. And, you know, I would quit. You know, I quit a couple of times in a fit of anger. And so I ended up leaving there finally. You know, Joe and I never really had any communication or relationship after that until many years later. I had three teenage daughters. I was working. I'd gone on to a successful career in advertising, working for ad agencies, got out of the journalism world and was into ad business. And I had a family trip down to California, and I thought I'd really like to go and say hello to Joe and introduce him to my family and just, you know, kind of rebuild that bridge.
Yeah.
And so I sent Joe a note or called him or whatever and got word to him that I'd really like to see him. And he was really lovely. He said, yes, come by all means, bring your family. And I came and we had a wonderful hour together. We were sitting in his boardroom and he was entertaining my daughters. And, you know, he was got to be 80. 80 years old then. Wow. You know, well along in years, but still the same old crazy guy. And and I remember apologizing to him at the time. I said, you know, I said a couple things in the heat of the moment back in the day that I regret. And, I just wanted to let you know I feel that way now and no hard feelings. And I think it really meant a lot to him because he took it to heart and it was great. It was a lovely little moment between us. Yeah. And then, you know, a few years later, he died. And I got a call one evening from John Balick, who I managed to stay in touch with a little bit over the years. And John said, Arnold is having a kind of a memorial service for Joe, kind of a commemorative tribute day for Joe in Santa Monica. I can't remember, it was 2010 or whatever year Joe died.
Yeah.
And he said, Arnold said to John, that it'd be nice to have Jack down. And so I came at John's invitation. I flew down.
Oh, wow.
And saw a lot of the guys from the day. And I was shocked at how much Franco looked different. And, you know, all the different guys, Albert Busick was there and Arnold. And I didn't spend too much time with any of them. It was like there was literally hundreds and hundreds of people there.
Yeah.
But, you know, guys were telling their favorite Joe stories. Everyone was doing a Joe imitation, of course. But I remember it was a lovely way to remember Joe finally.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I had a chance to kind of put aside any differences that we had had. I look back on those days with huge fondness and it was a great privilege to be part of it for 3-4 years, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That was such a special time in bodybuilding when you were around with it, Jack, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. I think we, you know, it's not the same. Everything changes, of course, but there was a lot of great characters. And like you said, it wasn't lifting weights and having a bodybuilder body was really unusual. So we had our own little subcult. It wasn't out there like it is today, you know, so it was really a special time.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And I must admit, I don't really follow it closely. Occasionally, I'll leaf through a magazine or follow something online. Yeah. But, you know, the nature of the physiques, they are so different. It just isn't like it was. And, you know, I salute the guys that put in the effort and dedication to get that way. But, man, it just isn't quite the golden era.
No. Yeah, they were more relatable back then. I remember being like a kid and looking at Mike Mentzer or Robbie or Arnold, and even though they were really great, I could even see myself like saying, I could look like that one day. And that would motivate you, you know, to really train hard because you want to look like your heroes.
But, well, you did some great things yourself. I mean, didn't you win the Natural Olympia?
Yeah, I won the first Natural Olympia.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's a huge achievement. Yeah.
But I think back then you could relate to the guys, you know, where now I think the guys are so big. I don't know how they could even relate to that. I don't know how it inspires the admiration that we had, you know.
Well, you read stories of guys dying way before their time.
Yeah,
and,
you know,
that it really takes a toll, the regimen you have to follow.
I know. So what are you doing now, Jack?
Well, I'm retired. I'm 65.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Great.
And I'm retired. I've gone through some health issues the last year with my kidneys and stuff, but I've got that under control.
Oh, good.
I haven't been training with weights for some time, but I was in really good shape when I was about 50. Okay. Best shape I'd ever been in, actually. And,
really?
And more recently, I had to stop. But I'm actually, now that I've got myself kind of back on an even keel, I'm going to pick up with the weights again.
Good.
And, hopefully we can get this pandemic behind us soon and get back to a normal life. I know it's compromised everything, but this is the world we live in.
I know. I just saw Rick Wayne posted something on Facebook yesterday. He said he's going to work on a book about bodybuilding. Have you ever?
Yeah, I saw that. I noticed you invited him to be part of this podcast.
Yeah. I've tried to get him on. Maybe you could send him a personal message.
I'll give him a good word. Yeah. I'll still stay in touch. He's a great, you should get him. He's a wonderful guy.
I've been dying to get him. I loved all his books and his articles and everything, you know?
Yeah. He's a wonderful man.
Have you ever thought about doing that, Jack? Writing a book about your experiences in bodybuilding?
Yes. Well, I actually have been working on a memoir of my misspent youth.
Oh, awesome.
from my early childhood. There's all kinds of stories people don't even know about up through the Weider years. And then it ends at that time. Okay. So I actually do plan on bringing out something about that. I gave away my Arnold gun shooting story that will be in the book, but you heard it here first. Anyway, Share a little. It won't be about bodybuilding only. Yeah. It'll be about my childhood mostly, which is unusual. But But I've been kind of waylaid from that recently. I'm going to get back to writing and hope to get that done the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, you're a wonderful writer, so I really enjoyed reading your stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, Jack. Well, thank you for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legend Show. This was a great interview. It was everything I hoped for, and you had some great stories, and I really appreciate you joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Good luck with it, and let me know when it goes live, and I'll put it out on social media and get some time for you.
Absolutely. All right. Hopefully, we can have you on again, too. I'd love to hear some more of your stories.
Okay. Cheers, man. All the best to you, John.
All right. Thanks, Jack. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you again to Jack Neary. What a great interview. It was such a pleasure to talk to Jack, especially after growing up so many years ago, reading all his articles in Muscle Builder magazine. All these years later, I get to interview him and hear all these great stories. So thanks to Jack for doing that. And thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to all our generous Patreon donors who continue to support the podcast every month by donating some money to the podcast. I really appreciate you guys. You help out more than you realize. If you wish to be a Patreon donor, you can just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com, which is the official website for the podcast. And in the upper right-hand corner, you will see a link where you can donate to the podcast. And I appreciate all you guys who do that, as I said. All right, before we let you guys go, I want to read a couple articles here from Jack Neary from Muscle Builder Magazine. This one was really good. It was about Robbie Robinson. I believe this was in 1979, probably. Said, he's paid his dues. Now he's being paid back. There nowhere exists a power which does not seek to increase itself. Pierre Elliott Trudeau. It has taken a decade for Robbie Robinson to pull himself free from the torturous memory of the Vietnam War, which has clung to him like some jumpsuit of constricting necrotic skin. His muscular body is scored with strips of shiny scar tissue, but these physical graffiti of combat were minor wounds that healed quickly. It has taken a considerably longer time to extract the psychic bullets of war sunk deeply into the sensitive and not entirely invulnerable mind of this 32-year-old bodybuilding champion. If we can reach a unanimous conclusion about war, it is that no man who experiences it will go unaffected. We may monitor its physical casualties by counting body bags or measuring gauze bandages, but we will have to venture further through uncharted geography to record its toll on men's minds. Robbie Robinson can tell you the results are not pretty. When I first got drafted into the Army, a sergeant asked me what I wanted to do in life, said Robinson in an interview. I told him I wanted to be a bodybuilder, and he sort of laughed. He said, the only kind of weights you'll get in the Army are 250 caliber machine guns. Well, I never thought I'd be sent to war, but I had an innate fear. After a year and 20 days in Nam, I was not in good shape mentally. When I got back home to Tallahassee, Florida, I was a wreck. I was at the Greyhound bus station there, standing beside this big bus, and all of a sudden the bus started with a roar, and wham, I hit the ground scared. It was a reflex action. I thought I was being shelled. Those who do not know Robinson, there aren't many persons who do, often mistake his cold, unpassionate exterior in the gym and other public places as a sign of unfriendliness or misanthropy. Good friends will pass him in the gym, their eyes searching for his, looking for a glimmer of acknowledgement. But most times, the Robinson face remains taciturn, fixed in a baleful stare. And if one can read anything into this expression, it is, please respect my silence. There will be plenty of time for chat later. It is then best to leave the space about Robinson inviolate. He has armored himself with this defense mechanism for many years. What he is protecting, of course, is a surprisingly emotional interior, one that is seldom unscathed through some of the most routine encounters. Imagine then what Army life was to 19-year-old Robbie Robinson. I was drafted as soon as I got out of high school, he said. I was sent to boot camp at Fort Benning, Georgia. At that time, I was keen on bodybuilding and I wanted to play football. But I was awed going into the service. I was the only one in my family that had ever been. After a while, Army life didn't agree with me. I had a bad attitude. I was young, recently married, and I'd never been away from my family. I couldn't deal with it. It was hard for me mentally. The sergeants were especially hard on me, I think, because I had a muscular body. As a means of relieving anxiety, Robinson would jam his fist beneath the framework of his bunk bed and try to curl the entire structure.
By the time he was sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, Robinson realized he better change his attitude or he'd be dishonorably discharged. It was at Fort Dix that Robinson had his first brush with physical danger. While practicing parachute jumps from a tower, Robinson's chute failed to deploy completely, hurtling him 100 feet into a pit of sand. Miraculously, he was not hurt. All I remember was coming to waist deep in sand. Nobody could believe my legs weren't broken. I guess it was the weight training that saved me. When word came he would be shipped overseas, Robinson was shocked. I called my wife and I said, "I won't be coming home. I'm going to Nam." She started crying. But I never thought of dying. Being there and seeing so many around me die, that scared me. Grisly images of combat still plague Robinson's dreams. Indeed, his recollection of jungle fighting in Southeast Asia is not pleasant. I remember there were guys we called night fighters. They'd take whole bottles of speed and they'd be up high all the time. They'd be wound up at such a key pitch. It was like they could sense Charlie, the Viet Cong, before they even got to him. People in the gym don't know what death and pain is, but you know it over there. You'd walk along and you'd see guys you knew blown apart. An arm over there, a leg over here with the shoe still on. Gross, man, but that's the reality of war. The government would report back names of guys missing in action, but actually these guys would be so ruined by syphilis and VD that they couldn't send them home. There were all kinds of stories about that sort of thing that never got back here, but it's true. Charlie was bad. He'd be soaring on opium and he'd come running out of the jungle at you and the machine guns would shoot his legs right off and he'd still be coming on stumps. Charlie would put bounties out to get you so that for you it was just minute-to-minute survival. Death was always looking at you. I hear guys in the gym say, "I'm tired." What is tired? They don't have any idea. Packing through the jungle days on end, that's tired. The jungle is full of terror. There were these tunnel rats and bamboo vipers. One bite and you'd die fast. There's a scar approximately an inch and a half long marring the skin below Robinson's right eye. Another scar about the same size surmounts the flesh of his right lower thigh. His story about how he was wounded is not for the squeamish. We were on a long march through the jungle when suddenly we were ambushed. Bullets were flying everywhere and the guys were dropping around me. I was grazed across the cheek. At first I thought it was much worse because blood was all over my face, but I was lucky. I was lying down and some guy had fallen across me, and when the shooting stopped, Charlie came walking around the bodies, stabbing them with bayonets to see if anyone was alive. They got to me and I was so still, I guess it looked like I was dead with all the blood. One of them stabbed me in the thigh. Oh, that hurt, but I couldn't make a whimper. That was the toughest thing I ever had to do. With the temperature in Vietnam as high as 112 degrees and the humidity just shy of that, training for Robinson was not productive. There was a shed provided for physical activity, but it was ill-equipped for weight training. Army grub was poor, the portions meager, and the weight fell off Robinson. When I went there, I weighed 205. When I got back, I was 185. But that didn't really bother me because I knew I could gain it back quickly. What worried me was how my wife would accept me. When I got back to the States, there were a lot of families waiting for GIs. I was standing beside this one guy who had a lot of his face destroyed by shrapnel. When his wife came walking along, she walked right past him. She didn't recognize him. That really touched me. The whole war experience has hurt. It took me a long time to adjust, a long time to relate to people. I think just now I found myself. It took that long. Once home, Robinson found a job in a book packing company. He worked there for 6 months before moving on to the Tallahassee Democrat, where for 7 years he worked in the wire room as a copy boy. He enjoyed the job, but Robinson lived for bodybuilding. The best gym to train at was at Florida State University. I was getting good then, and the other bodybuilders there kept me at a distance. They knew I was the guy to watch. Sometimes they wouldn't let me train at their gym. I don't know why. It was like a hangar-like structure of skylights. At night, me and my training buddies, Ira Walker and Greg Hogan, would go up to the roof of this building and we'd break in through the skylights. We'd take one 30-watt bulb along, which gave us enough light to see, but not enough for the police to notice outside. And we trained like maniacs every night. The mosquitoes there were bad. We'd be doing a set and the mosquitoes would be biting. And as soon as you put the bar down, you'd be swatting them away. It made us train faster. During this time, when Robinson was starting to win every title in the region, he became sick with pericarditis, an inflammation of the heart sac. It has caused him a great deal of suffering until a year ago when the condition eased. I still get a little pain when I'm under stress, but nothing like it used to be. I don't know all the technicalities of the problem, but as my body grew, so grew my heart. At times it would become so large that it would press up into my throat, and that was very painful. Every once in a while, I had a coast in my workouts to give my heart a rest and let it reduce in size. For me, that was hard because I don't like to baby myself. Nearly 2 years ago, Robinson suffered what he calls a heart attack. He was sitting in his Venice, California apartment when a great surge of pain in the heart stiffened him, forcing his breath to come out in gasps. The sweat poured off him, and his skin color, he said, turned the shade of mustard. Elaine, his wife, rushed me to the hospital. I was dazed. The doctors took one look at me and started jabbing me with all kinds of needles and tubes in me. I was mass hysteria. I remember one nurse grabbing hold of my arm and crying out, but in astonishment, "Good Lord, look at these arms. He's too big." And they had a hell of a time finding a vein to stick the IV into. Seems the blood vessels just regressed deep into the muscles. After a few hours, my condition was stable, and the doctor told me I'd have to quit training with weights and spend at least 2 weeks in bed, maybe more. That did it. Enough of this, I thought. I yanked the tubes out of my arm and walked out of the hospital. The next morning, I was in the gym training. Nobody had any idea what had happened. For all the grief the heart condition seemed to have given Robinson, it did not hinder his progress as a bodybuilder. After winning nearly 100 contests, Robinson stepped into the bigger arena, the 1975 AAU Mr. America in Los Angeles, California. Competitors, judges, and spectators were stunned to see this ebony marvel take his place on stage with some of the day's best amateurs. Outside the southwestern part of the country, Robinson was virtually unknown. Joe Weider remembers the contest. "I was sitting there and out walked Robbie," said Weider, whose best talent is assessing potential. "Of course, none of us knew who he was, and we couldn't believe this guy. He was so good, and then they only gave him fifth place. That seemed way off." For all the outcry by those around him, Robinson did not seem upset with his place. "It didn't bother me. I was happy to get the most muscular award. It was good. But I look at the pictures of that contest now, and, well, I look terrible compared to now. All those other guys were known, and I was unknown. I thought it was a thrill. I walked on stage, hit five poses, and watched the rest walk on stage after hitting five poses." A day after the contest, Weider summoned Robinson. An offer was made. Robinson should come west and join the Weider team. The rest, as they say, is history. "I went back to Florida after the contest feeling high about the offer," said Robinson. "I was in college at the time taking commercial art. I'd been divorced for a couple of years. At college, I met Red," his nickname for Elaine, "and I married her shortly after. She's very talented in art, specifically interior design. Well, she was entrenched in her thing there and quite close to her family, who I might add never approved of me. They thought, who is this bodybuilder and how's he going to support our daughter, who was always used to the best? But I went back there and I had my heart set on going back to California. So I told Red, you can come with me or you can stay here, but make up your mind. She took the chance with me and I'll always be grateful for that because I needed her support. When I was first out here, I didn't have a lot other than the money Joe gave me weekly. You know, I thought that was really something because he didn't even have to do that, but I didn't know where my next meal was coming from." Robbie's story is not without its element of Horatio Alger. As he reminisced through our interview in his luxurious condominium, he was constantly fitting with various expensive bric-a-brac that decorated the table near the high-back rattan chair. One of his favorite pieces is an antique bronze statue of Mercury, whose winged feet seemed to kick up an invisible cloud of dust. On the other side of his chair was a huge aquarium thriving with numerous species of sea life in lordly fashion. Robinson entertained us that evening with detailed personality analysis of each fish. Elaine sat amidst a pile of cushions on a Persian rug, smiling at our compliments for the useful decor of the room, which was her work. "I probably enjoyed a better relationship with Joe than any other bodybuilder," said Robinson. "We've never had a fight. Believe it or not, he treats me like a son. He gives me a lot of publicity and look around and see what it's done for me." Weider has a mutual admiration for Robinson. During a recent photo shoot at Gold's Gym, Weider was overheard saying, "You know that Robbie is amazing? He's the fastest learner of all the bodybuilders. You tell him once and he catches on." The Weider-Robinson marriage has been fortunate for both men. Extensive coverage in the magazine helped Robinson's mail order business grow incredibly. To manage the business and Robinson's exhibitions and seminar dates, Elaine postponed her own work in interior design. "I like bodybuilding now," she said, "but I didn't understand it at first. I didn't want to accept it. I never even heard of bodybuilding until I met Rob. I was faced with the ultimatum to go to California or stay in Florida. And I went with him because I love my husband. I definitely feel proud of him. Any woman would. He's in the public eye and women are attracted to him. I have a certain amount of jealousy, but it used to be worse. But I have the security knowing he loves me. Handling his mail orders has set my career back. At present, I can't see getting back into it. I'm too busy. I put the marriage first." According to Elaine, 25, bodybuilding has made her a better person. There was a time when she was reclusive and her infrequent encounters with other bodybuilding people were not always joyous occasions. But, she said, her attitude has changed and now she enjoys traveling with Robinson. I'm in the process of writing a 3-volume book on total physique display for the male bodybuilder, Elaine said. I want it to be a reference book for beginners, but it'll have Robbie's story too. Robbie's story is not without its moments. Under Weider's tutelage, Robinson went on to win the AFAB Mr. America and Mr. World titles before being beaten by Ken Waller at the 1975 Universe in South Africa. The next year, Robinson won the Universe in Montreal. As a professional, he's won numerous events, but in 2 tries, his greatest query, the Olympia, has eluded him. In my first Olympia in 1977, I miscalculated something and I came in puffy. I looked better a couple of days after. Joe said, Robbie, what did you do? And I said, I didn't know, but it's too late after the show. Losing that show upset me. In the second Olympia the next year, I was better prepared. Maybe not at my best, though, but I couldn't win that either. Frank Zane beat me both times. Now, second is no disgrace, especially to Frank. He's a champion. I appreciate the type of body he's got. I just can't knock him while others do. He presents himself like a winner when it counts, and he wins. I watch him at the contest when I'm up on stage with him, and I notice he's into his own thing. He doesn't seem to be aware of anybody but himself. Robinson is not happy with defeat. That is obvious from the post-contest funk he slips into, but it's apparent he's done an overhaul on his attitude during the past few months. Winning is the most important thing for me, but you can't win all the time. You can pick 25,000 judges, and each one's looking for a different thing. So I do my best. I don't worry about who I have to beat because I have no control over them. And I go out there and accept the results. My posing, or should I say my presentation, has improved so much that I'm overwhelmed myself. I feel really good about what I'm doing. You know, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll nudge Red and say, that's it. Hey, Red, I've got the weirdest movement. I live for the gym. There's no other place I'd rather be but in the gym training. So I'm always thinking of new exercises to create something freaky. If it works, no matter how weird, I'll do it. It's those weird ones that make me look finished. I've got all the foundation I need. Now I just want to refine my body. Robinson's training hasn't always been so eclectic. His introduction to the sport is not extraordinary. At age of 15, after seeing Muscle Men in the comic book, he told his sister he wanted to be a big bodybuilder. She didn't know what bodybuilder was. Without the money to buy weights or join a gym, young Robinson innovated by strapping 2 inner tubes to the end of a brass bed. With these, he could curl, press, and pull, and although I didn't know what I was doing, I was growing. But not without his mother's chagrin. She ran me out of the house. She didn't want me sweating on the floor she just scrubbed. So I moved my gym outside. I got a barbell made from 2 train wheels, and I'd squat that. I cut up my t-shirts for show. All of a sudden, I had muscles. I'd go to school, and the kids weren't ready for that. They thought I was a freak. My football coach told me to quit or I'd be muscle bound. Now the school's got loads of equipment, so it shows how weight training has come. Robinson's always worked hard. In the summers, he'd help his father at a lumber mill. At school, he was always an all-state athlete in track and on the gridiron. Robinson is probably bodybuilding's most singular man. Indeed, the individualism has even rankled some bodybuilding railbirds. A year ago, the magazine was rife with controversy about Robinson's gym attire, which usually includes cornrowed braids, a pendant or two, a gold earring, a tailored t-shirt, and several pairs of socks. The person who cared the least about what the brouhaha is Robinson, who said, hey, my dress doesn't hurt anybody. I don't bug others in the gym, so why should anybody bug me? Robinson's more interested in self-improvement. I've done a lot with my body. Now I want to make the right investments with my money. I don't want to train myself into the ground. I need something to fall back on. I don't care about being a millionaire. Even if there was no money in bodybuilding, I'd still compete. I just love bodybuilding. Every day I seem to reach a new level. I want to keep learning. I'd love to win the Olympia, but I want to win on my own merits. I'm enjoying life more now that I'm getting involved with more projects. I've got my bodybuilding camps back east this summer, and that's already a great success. Yeah, I paid my dues, and now I'm enjoying the rewards. All right, so that was our Robbie Robinson article by Jack Neary. Now I've got another article here, which is a flash report of the 1979 Night of the Champions, where Robbie barely beat Danny Padilla. It says, Robbie remains cool in tie, breaking pose down to edge past Padilla. Using the poise and experience of a veteran, Robbie Robinson edged past Danny Padilla in a tie-breaking pose down to win the Night of the Champions 2 before 2,700 fans here September 12th. Using the poise and experience of a veteran, Robbie Robinson edged past Danny Padilla in a tie-breaking pose down to win the Night of the Champions 2 before 2,700 fans here May 12th. It was his second consecutive victory in 5 weeks. Robinson's last year's Night of the Champions winner took home $6,000 in winning his fourth pro event. Padilla earned $2,000 for his best performance yet. Third place and $1,600 went to Mike Mentzer. Boyer Co. placed fourth worth $1,200. And a much-improved Bill Grant took fifth at $1,000. Going into the final pose down, after three rounds of scoring, Padilla had Robinson by 1 point, 300 to 299. Mentzer trailed closely with 297. After the five finalists completed a grueling pose down, the judges reported a tie for first between Danny Padilla and Robbie Robinson. A second and final confrontation between the two was called to decide it. Under pressure, Robbie remained calm, pacing himself and hitting his best shots, while Padilla, when he wasn't relying on his overwhelmingly most muscular pose, seemed slightly intimidated as he posed erratically and without the controlled zest he'd shown in the previous rounds. Indeed, it was an event which marked the emergence of Padilla as a true threat to the Olympia. With flawless proportions and very good definition, Padilla abandoned his taciturn, phlegmatic persona of yore as he posed to Randy Newman's hit single, Short People. With showmanship and a touch of the ham, Padilla turned the majority of the sellout crowd to his favor. But by the final pose down, not even his newfound spirit could contend with the superbly honed Robinson and his awesome physique. All I know is I went out there and I did my best, said an elated Padilla moments after the decision. I went up against the greatest, Robbie, but it wasn't easy for him. He knew I was there. A tired but satisfied Robinson admitted afterwards in the dressing room that it may have been his toughest contest to date. It was a battle, said Robinson. I was behind up until the end, but I wasn't going to quit. I knew if I just stayed calm and gave him my best in the pose down, that I'd stay with him. I just want to rest. I'm tired. 3 weeks of shows, that's a lot. Those were Mentzer's feelings following the event. Slightly off his best form, Mentzer slipped a notch in the mandatory round, but surged back with a perfect score in the free posing. But it seemed he was on the run all contest long. Well, after the morning rounds, I kind of expected I'd take third, said Mentzer. I was so tired going into the show. After so many weeks of preparation, my body just didn't want to respond. I won't be going into so many contests so close together again. Ken Waller made an impressive comeback from elbow surgery. Despite his superb shape, he placed sixth. Behind him was Joe Nazario, looking very muscular. An overweight Ed Corney remained the sentimental favorite of the crowd, drawing the largest ovation of the evening as he posed to Sinatra's My Way. Other competitors were Annabelle Lopez, Bill Mitchell, and Franklin Green. All right, so that was our second article, and I've got one more article to read here. This is from our friend from Sweden, Mr. William Chill, who is a writer himself, as he said. So I'm going to read this right now for you guys. All right, it says, "No place like it in the world. Memories of my first gym." The gym was called Newport Barbell, and it sat on the corner of Market Street and Shadyside in Youngstown, Ohio. The building used to be an old furniture showroom with large picture windows facing the street. Passersby would sometimes stop and gaze inside to catch a momentary glimpse of the curious characters working out. You would enter the gym from the side door, glance briefly at the warped poster stapled to the door advertising an old boxing match that had taken place years ago, and then enter. Me and a couple of my high school friends ventured into the place for the first time in the spring of 1980. We were in the middle of an economic recession that year. The Soviets were bogged down in Afghanistan. Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall was the number one hit song on the radio. And Arnold Schwarzenegger would win his seventh Mr. Olympia title in Sydney, Australia. It was a spacious gym with low ceilings and exposed pipes and ductwork. A series of ratty gray carpets covered the floor. None of the equipment matched, and the barbells and dumbbells were browned with the patina of history, like an old penny. There were posters of Arnold, Franco, Tom Platz, and Frank Zane taped to the walls to provide the essential motivation. I'll never forget the magazine clipping that someone taped to the wall in front of the squat rack. It was an advertisement for the movie Paradise Alley, with a badass-looking Sylvester Stallone dressed in a black leather jacket, gray flat cap, and a cigarette hanging from his mouth. Whenever you came up from a squat, that picture would come into view, and you'd become instantly motivated to take another descent. I still keep this image in my head to this day when I train. Every weekday between 4 and 5 p.m., the crew would start to file in, guys of all ages and all walks of life, but they were mostly blue-collar guys from the city. iron workers, electricians, mechanics, cops, and firemen. "How you doing?" was the common greeting exchanged between the lifters when they first entered. The usual reply was a weary shake of the head followed by, "Just trying to make a living." They ranged from loud, hardcore bodybuilders in torn sweatshirts to stoic hospital orderlies in scrubs who read the newspaper in between sets of bench presses. The equipment was old, the ceiling was low, and the stereo loud. There were usually some well-thumbed issues of muscle and fitness stashed in the corner, which you would sometimes read between sets. We had a nickname for everybody in the gym. As 17-year-old high school students, we were easily enamored by the colorful characters as assembled there. Some nicknames were more or less just embellishments of their real names that highlighted their personas, such as Big Ralph or Crazy Eddie, while other names we made up because they fit, such as The Bug, a big and stocky guy with a round face and frizzy hair, who we've carefully recorded every set into a well-worn stenographer's pad with a ballpoint pen. The prison lifters, two serious guys who worked out in gray sweats and black skull caps. The old pro, a guy in his 50s with great arms and military-style crew cut. The scientist, a team of two intense guys whose workout routines followed the latest routines published in Joe Weider's Muscle and Fitness. Rest pause training, drop sets, reverse ladders, they did it all. They were gritty guys from the city and probably would have kicked our asses if they knew we were making up all these stupid names, but they were like gods to us, and being in the gym felt like the best place in the world to be. Despite the initial intimidating atmosphere, some of the guys would take us under their wings, give us tips about lifting, girls, and life in general. Much of their advice we eagerly embraced, some of it was total shit. Like Crazy Eddie telling me that the key to good deadlifting was to get a good bounce off the floor. But anyway, those guys were our idols since we didn't have access to Franco and Arnold. Besides, pretty much everything worked when you were training for the first time. We watched the Goliaths saunter around the gym, their well-worn leather lifting belts loosened to the last hole in between sets. Some would hang outside the doorway to get some air, their belts hanging down low on the waist like Western gunslingers. Today's gym etiquette says that the weight belt is not a decoration to adorn the waist, but back then you could earn the right to do so if you had enough time underneath the barbell. Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones routinely blasted out of the JVC stereo system, and when it did, pretty much everyone joined in on the chorus of woo-woo, woo-woo, even in the middle of a set. From the serious bodybuilders to the football players, powerlifters, and just regular Joes, we were all together in the moment. With Stallone watching over us from his view in the squat rack, we were invincible. There were no contracts in those days. You paid your membership fees in cash, 1 month, 3 months, a year, whatever. And when you were coming up on the end of your term, the owner, Jim Willish, would chase you around the gym until you paid up. Gym fees were handwritten in magic marker on a piece of artboard taped to the wall. Payments were recorded in a green hardcover notebook with a felt-tip pen. There were no computers back then. Common gym attire consisted of gray sweats and a flannel shirt, often worn over a white thermal underwear top. Many guys wore work boots. This workout fashion became a bit of a fad within bodybuilding circles when David and Peter Paul, a.k.a. the Barbarian Brothers, were featured in Muscle and Fitness with their hardcore training regimens and animalistic image. But guys in Youngstown didn't follow fads. They dressed that way because they came to the gym straight from work. The crew in the gym consisted of various cliques. He had a small group of competitive bodybuilders led by a guy named John, whose dense, compact physique had us in a constant state of awe. He drove a red Camaro Z28 and made you take your shoes before getting inside. There was a group of powerlifters who performed their workouts in a cloud of white chalk dust on the wooden platform in the corner. They wore thick power belts, and at the end of their workout, I noted how they carefully rolled up their knee wraps, which back then were little more than ace bandages, before placing them in their gear bags. But I would say the majority of the lifters were guys who just lifted. Many trained with the same energy and intensity as the guys who competed, and there was always a drama being performed in the squat rack. One of the guys, Bill Biggs, would pace back and forth in front of the squat rack, yelling out his patented, "Strong, strong, strong," before addressing the bar while his entourage looked on. He would then grab the bar, pull himself under it, and crank out a set with the plates rattling. No one used collars back then. When he was done, he'd rack the bar with an eye-bugging scream. There was nothing like the day when Frank Zane came to the gym to give a seminar. He was passing through town for some event or another, and Willish managed to book him into the gym one Saturday for a question and answer session. I'd never seen anything like him before. He was surreal, deeply tanned and possessing a vascularity that was otherworldly. Don't let anyone ever say Frank was small. He was larger than life. At the end of the seminar, he offered to sign autographs, and he signed my thin leather lifting belt, and black magic marker. The seasons came and went, and life moved on. During the summer, between my junior and senior years of college, the gym closed. A few guys from the original crew got together and opened up a new gym in a freshly renovated plaza storefront. It was fully equipped and a great place to work out, but it just wasn't the same. As the late 80s turned into the 90s, things became glitzier, cleaner. Grit was out of style. Frank Zane's autograph on my leather lifting belt eventually faded, but my memory didn't. I still train, and during every workout, I still think of Newport Barbell. I live in Sweden now, but I get back to Youngstown every year to visit my family and show my kids a little of where I grew up. Today, there's a pizza joint in the building where the gym used to be, and I pointed out to them. I would venture to guess that not too many people remember when it used to be a gym. I use a thicker, more modern lifting belt these days, but I'll bust out the old weightlifting belt every now and then and sling it around my waist when I train, mostly with the hope that someone will ask me about what the deal is with the curious piece of leather, and I can tell them about the old days. All right. So thank you for that article, William, and thanks for listening to the show. So that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Next week, we'll be back with an interview with 1969 Mr. America, John DeCola. All right, everybody, take care, keep lifting hard, and we'll see you next week. Take care.